Alright, good afternoon everybody. Welcome back to the Beauty and the Beast Physical Therapy and Strength Conditioning Podcast. I am joined as always by my co-host Dr. Ross Childs.
Hey everyone, how's it going? Good to be back again. Even though what it was just last week, right? Feels like longer than that.
Yeah, these weeks are... They're not dragging when you're in them, but like the next week when you're looking back, it feels like it's been a month.
Well, I feel like I was just talking to a patient today about it. Like, can we believe it's already the middle of June?
Nope.
Like, I really feel like I just got happy that it was the middle of February, and now we're already in the middle of June, and usually the time goes by relatively slow from New Year's to the 4th of July, or average.
Right.
And then usually after that, it's a shitstorm. Warp speed to Christmas.
Yeah.
I mean, I just feel like there's no time to stop and kind of smell the roses. Just nope. Been warp speed the whole time. So, just... It's fun to sometimes sit and reflect on that. How's everything been with you?
Good. Busy in different ways, but...
Yeah, still working all that stuff behind the scenes on your business.
Yeah. Yep.
Doesn't it seem like that shit never ends?
Yep.
Doesn't matter how much time you put into it. And I don't know about you, but my problem is I start working on something, and then I'll have two more ideas.
Yeah.
And then those two ideas turn to four ideas, and then it's like, no, I can always make this better.
Yeah.
So something I should have completed a week ago is now extended out four more weeks because I'm an asshole.
Yep, now I have three half-completed things.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I've had to learn, finish one project and move on. So, I'm always better at giving advice than taking my own, so... All right, guys, for this week, we're going to kind of take a step back from the clinical stuff. So hopefully you guys took a lot of key points away from that. Again, diagnosing the different body parts that we talked about or self-diagnosing. And again, self-diagnosing, I'm putting in air quotes. Also give you a better idea of what type of classification you may fall in, which will help to better direct your treatment. We're taking more of a lighthearted day today. Adam and I thought it was good to kind of just sit back and kind of reflect upon our careers and what we've learned in that time, things that we would do differently, and kind of just have more of a laid back kind of day. So hopefully you guys enjoy it, and we'll go from there. So Adam, why don't you just give everyone a reminder of your background so they know where we're at today.
Yeah, so we've talked about this a little bit before, but just it's been a bit, and for those of you that may be new, so pretty much my physical fitness journey, I guess, if you want to put it that way, started in high school when I first started lifting, which was my sophomore, junior year of high school. And I enjoyed it, but was definitely going more like sports management type stuff when I was going to college. That was my plan until I got into college and realized how much sports management is business.
Yeah.
And quickly realized that was not a passion of mine and started moving towards... sports medicine type. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do at the time. I had thoughts of maybe going for physical therapy. I had thoughts of maybe going, working at a hospital or that type of thing. I didn't really necessarily plan on going the personal trainer route just because of the available options from a sports medicine or an exercise physiology degree, it definitely seemed like the most challenging path in terms of building a sustained career.
Sure.
Is the best way to put it. Definitely going to, school for physical therapy and stuff like that is more academically challenging, but in terms of building a career, I feel like leaving school with a physical therapy degree or a exercise physiology degree that you go for like cardiac rehab or something like that are usually a little bit more stable than
correct.
Than training or coaching, so I really didn't end up getting into coaching as much until I was actually more out of school.
Yep.
The very tail end of my senior year and then getting out of it, started an internship at in Summersworth at Seacoast Orthopedic and Sports Medicine, and then kind of from there started working at Get Fit, and the rest is history, and that was 2013. So it was 10 years ago.
Oh, my God. You're an old bastard. That's all
I know, right?
Just wait until we have our 20-year show.
I know.
What's changed in the 20 years? now, a question for you. Now that you've been doing this for 10 years now, do you look back and say, well, shit, I wish I did something different?
A little bit. It's a lot of little stuff. building, like, being more, paying more attention to, like, building my own brand, my own, you know, just, like, being on Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that more, just because that would have helped me a lot.
Sure.
Into my, my later, into now, if I had built all that up and kind of followed through with a lot of that stuff, but I don't know that there's a whole ton I would have changed, to be honest with you. I feel like most of the stuff that I, you know, could we all, you know, could I have done better about, you know, investing money, saving money? Like, if we're not talking specifically, like, my career, like, sure, what I learned in the books, then obviously there are things. But, I mean, I've been pretty happy with the things that I spent money on continuing education on, the, you know, the, I had to go through the split shifts and all that sort of stuff, like all the other fitness professionals do at some point. And, you know, that kind of grind helps push you when you're, you know, further down the line. So I don't know that I would, that I would change a whole lot, but definitely to, you know, be more cognizant of things that were going to be coming up, like, in later years, things that I needed to start now, getting that following, getting all that sort of stuff.
Now, if time, energy, effort, all that shit was not an issue at all for anyone, is there another profession that you would change to in a heartbeat?
So, this is kind of a, well, I mean, in a perfect world, you know, I love playing, like, fantasy football and stuff like that, and I follow a bunch of podcasts to talk about, like, my all-time dream would be to be able to do something like that as my job.
That's pretty, like, cool. Just, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, like, just be able to talk, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be fantasy football, but, like, you know, the anchors that are on SportsCenter and like the Get and on GetUp and all that sort of stuff, like, that would be my dream, like, absolute dream job, just to get to sit around and talk about sports all the time. And just, like, as I mean, like, I know that it's not as glamorous on the inside as it seems like on the outside, but when you
I think that would be fun, talking sports all the time. Gee, that sounds fucking hard.
So I think if that, or I, the more in my career that I've gotten into reading books about mindset and mentality and all that sort of stuff, I don't know if I don't know that I would necessarily go all the way to, like, psychiatry or something like that.
Sure.
But the way the human mind functions to me is extremely interesting, and I feel like in another multiverse somewhere, another place somewhere, that's probably something that I would find, that is something that I would find extremely interesting. You know, there's drawbacks to that, like there is to anything else, you know, with people you have to work with and things that you have to, you know, help people with and all that sort of stuff. But just that piece of it to me is extremely interesting. Those are the books that I always tend to gravitate towards more, that I'll listen to without stopping, that I have no trouble finishing books that deal with mindset or, you know, mental patterning, all that kind of stuff. That stuff is extremely interesting to me.
I mean, that's always, I mean, that's pretty cool. And chances are, if you were into that and I said, you know, or if you were doing that as your profession, I said, hey, is there any other profession that you do? You'd probably pick something else.
Right.
So it's just, it's human nature. I honestly don't know. I mean, dream job, like, not concerned with anything, I'd be like a fucking coffee roaster or something.
Right, yeah.
You know, that would be my thing.
Like a brewmaster.
Yeah, like that. I always thought that, I mean, everyone knows my love of coffee, so I just think that would be pretty awesome. I don't know, I enjoy what I do, and I'll get into my background in just a minute. I've put so much time, energy, and effort into it. I mean, I have the capacity to learn something else, but I can't see myself doing anything other than what I'm doing. And I'm lucky because I can do the clinical portion of it, and then I also can teach. So I enjoy where I'm at. But again, all things considered equal, oh man, I'll pick coffee beans and I'll roast them, and that to me sounds pretty friggin' phenomenal.
Yeah.
But so, as Adam said, we've touched upon our backgrounds before, and I'll try to make this short and sweet. So I've grown up playing sports, always very athletic. Started working out at 14. That's when my mother got me my first weight bench. And I remember it like it was yesterday. And then played high school hockey, junior hockey. And then at 21, stopped playing competitively. And then said, what the hell am I going to do with my life? And then it really was, well, I enjoy working out and I can guess I can get a degree with it. So during that process, started working for one of my professors who has his own fitness company in Mass. I became a personal trainer and a strength and conditioning coach. But realized that I was going to go on to grad school. So I really narrowed it down to med school, chiropractic, and PT. And there were no local chiropractic schools, so it ruled that out. And then med school would have taken another 2 years of prerequisites to get in. So I was left with physical therapy. And I wasn't even keen on the idea of it because I thought physical therapists only dealt with old people. And I was so wrong. And once I looked into it, I realized that a lot of my strength and conditioning background, undergrad training, really carried over to PT. So I got in at Franklin Pierce and did their physical therapy program. And then started working in the central New Hampshire area, and I've been doing it for 12 years, somewhere around there. Had a lot of great experiences, really wouldn't trade any of them because they've all gotten me to this point, you know, and I feel like I'm pretty lucky. I'm at the point clinically where I'm happy what I do. Mm-hmm. So not a lot of clinicians can say that. I feel like a lot of clinicians kind of just go through the day-to-day routine. They run through the motions. So I'm pretty fortunate, but I've earned it. You know, I've put in a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get here. So I'm glad I'm at a place where professionally I'm relaxed, I'm comfortable. So yeah, that's kind of the cool part. So now the nice part when you said we're going to do this show, it was like, all right, retrospective, let's reflect on our careers. And I was like, all right, well, there's a lot that we can talk about. So what's the one thing that you would tell yourself if you could go back and tell your younger self at the start of this journey?
For me?
Yeah.
Be prepared to work hard and take... And it's funny because I always had this picture of personal training and coaching being a difficult field. So I don't feel like I ever really walked into it with, you know, rose-colored glasses where, oh, God, people are going to be paying me $100 an hour. I'm going to be making bank in no time. But I don't think I quite realized how long it takes to make a impact to the point that you are someone who people will come to without you having to constantly put yourself out there for, if that makes sense. So, like, I think it would be more along the lines of, like, you're going to have times where you're burnt out, where you're tired, where you feel like this was the wrong decision. You have to push through that.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's what I would tell myself if I were to go back. You know, outside of the stupid stuff I talked about before, and as far as the career stuff goes, that's probably what it would be. Learn as much as you can. I'd probably, you know, give myself some more people to follow that I... Because I had a very small network of people that I would follow when I first started. And they were all from people that, you know, I heard through the previous owner at Get Fit. Or, you know, so it was a really... It was a good group of coaches. I mean, it was Boyle. It was Danjon. It was Cressy. It was... Martin Rooney was the big one from the very beginning.
All the ones you'd see on T Nation, and they all presented for Perform Better.
Right. I mean, it was a fantastic... I mean, that was the core group, and I still believe that that is like... Like, those are like the four or five people that if somebody came up to me and said, who should I follow, start there, and then branch out.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, there are more names that I kind of wish I'd followed. Probably to trust myself a little bit more. Some of the programs I did at Get Fit, the advanced strength and power class, some of the other things I did, I actually had the idea to do stuff like that for a long time before I ever actually went after it, just because I wasn't confident enough that I knew what I was doing to be able to do that. But looking back, I probably could have started some of those programs within a couple years of starting at Get Fit.
Yeah.
Granted, it was a lot easier. But when I was, you know, further along in my career, but to start some of that stuff and have a little bit more confidence in my ability. What about you?
You know, and when I saw this question, I was really kind of taking some time to reflect on that. And I really think the one thing, if I had to tell myself, was kind of learn to be present. You know, I think that's something that we all fall victim to. But what I mean by that is, I have the I would call it more of a sickness, because I always spread myself too thin. I always say yes. I always try to challenge myself. So for me, it's always, I need to do this to get me here. Mm-hmm. So there's always, it's a stepping stone. And my life has always been that way, especially once I got to college, because it was always, I need to complete undergrad to get to grad school. I need to complete grad school to get to my first job and start making real money. You know, I need to start seeing this number of patients per week to kind of boost me up the ladder. I need to study for this exam so I can get this certification. I need to complete this round of schooling to get me this, to get me here. You know, so I'm kind of at the point now, yes, I'm still in school, but once I'm done with this next degree, I don't have a next goal.
Right.
So it's kind of scary. I would have wished I probably would have taken the time to kind of enjoy my accomplishments along the way. Because for me, it's always, all right, I finished one, on to the next. So I would tell my younger self, hey, you know, chill the fuck out. Let's enjoy life. Go travel.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Well, my relationship with money now is a lot different. Someone told me when you become a business owner, your relationship with money changes. I had no idea what the fuck they meant. But now I do. I don't really stress about it. I don't think about it the way I did before. So I didn't travel much when I was younger, especially just coming out of school. It's like, oh, I have money. I want to hold on to it, which I guess is better than the other end of the spectrum where people are just spending it. Enjoy the moment. You know, go see the world. You know, recognize that you are not your job. You know, you are someone who performs this job. You know, but really, life has to come first. So that's probably what I would definitely tell my younger self. Just get your head out of the ass and enjoy life.
So moving on to kind of the next one, what's one piece of information you wished you learned sooner? Whether it be about physical therapy, strength and conditioning?
So I think this can go for both strength and conditioning and physical therapy. I think what I wish I could learn sooner is really how to connect with people. Because it took a long time in my career to realize that I don't have to be so by the book or robotic. You know, especially when we teach students coming out of school, it's very robotic. They have to be very professional. Not saying that I'm not, but there's a certain perception mm-hmm. about what professionalism looks like. You know, it's like for anyone who's seen me, I have long hair and I throw it up in a bun and I have tattoos hanging out everywhere. If you saw me walking on the street, you probably wouldn't guess that I'm a professor. Probably wouldn't guess I own my own business, and that's just human nature. So, you know, really it's just the ability to connect with people, because now I feel like I connect with people much easier. Mm-hmm. I don't worry so much about the professional part as far as connecting with someone, developing the relationships with them. And I think that's why people also don't care what I look like, because I treat them just like a normal person. They're not a patient. So how to talk to people, figuring out what motivates them. So not really a technical aspect to my profession or strength and conditioning, but you know, I think you can probably agree with me that the ability for you to connect with clients and members makes just as much of a difference as the program itself. So for me to connect with someone, you know, that's even more important than my plan of care. I have to get buy-in. I have to connect with people. I have to learn who they are as a person. And I probably wasn't the most efficient at that when I was younger. So that's really the one big thing. And even in strength and conditioning, it was very, I have to make the best program. But why? You know, who am I making it for? What do they need to be able to do that I'm building this program for? So now I look back and it was like, I was too by the book. There was no humanistic approach to it. And now it's a more humanistic approach. And that could just be me being older and slightly more mature, but probably not. You know, just not sweating the little things as much. So, how about you?
I think one of the things that I kind of wish that I had learned earlier, and this is actually something that I really didn't fully understand until you and I started talking about it and we started doing the podcast and stuff like this. So it's really a fairly new understanding, and that's the understanding of pain. Most of my career, it was a lot of, if it hurts, don't do it. Or, you know, try and find something that's as close to it as possible. But if that movement causes any pain, I'm not talking a little bit of pain, any pain, then don't do it. And there are a lot of times that I can think of where that probably either held me back, whether it was my own pain when I was going through herniated disc stuff, back stuff, knee stuff, all that kind of stuff in the past,
yeah,
as well as with clients. I mean, I was always a big proponent of trying to find the closest thing possible. You know, if somebody's knees hurt on a goblet squat, I was trying to have them do, you know, a bodyweight squat or, you know, a TRX-assisted squat or something like that. But understanding that somebody that has some back soreness still can deadlift, it's okay if they're a little sore. It's okay if they feel a little bit of something at the time. That doesn't mean that there's a negative. Doesn't mean that there's an injury occurring. It doesn't mean that I'm making the injury worse.
Yep.
In fact, it probably means that, well, you know, within reason, that I'm making things better. And I wish I had understood that a little bit more, because a lot of my early education, early understanding was that, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, 0 being no pain at all, 10 being you can't even function, or you can't even think straight because you're in so much pain. If it was anything other than a 0, that meant that the exercise had to be adjusted somehow. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the case. Obviously, people differ from person to person, but that is something that I wish I understood earlier in my career.
And I would agree with that, because it took a long time for me to understand that. You know, just the difference being, I work with people in pain all the time. That's why they come to see me. So, you know, and I've really, patients, members, clients, you know, just insert X here. Sometimes someone's perception of what they're feeling is also not what they're relaying to us.
Mm-hmm.
So someone could say they're in pain, whereas someone else may say this is a strain from a workout. So, you know, or some people call, oh, it's not a pain, it's a discomfort. Well, it's a fucking sensation that we have to worry about. Is that sensation alarming enough that we have to do something about it? So the education piece is important, because again, I even in physical therapy, where we deal with pain all the time, you know, really there was always this conversation between pain versus no pain, and that's just not the case. It's just, even if someone has an acute injury, there's gonna be pain. What can we do to not make it worse? And then we get outside that acute phase. It's more subacute. Okay, we are going to have some flare-ups, but ideally we need to add load and tolerance. So as long as, again, we don't piss it off, we're okay. And then we get, you know, if someone turns more chronic at that point, it's like, we're not really going to care about pain. We're going to push. You know, we need to make you stronger. So it's just having that conversation with people, because oftentimes I feel people have discomfort and they say, my pain, which, again, I'm not saying they're not sensing that, but oftentimes it's lower, or it's not as harming as we would assume. It hurts, but we have to remember hurt and harm are two different things. So yeah, I would say that's changed the way that I treat people as well. And that was probably 7 years ago that I first really started learning about pain science education. So that's a good one. I think that was a good one that you picked. Now, what about one technical piece of knowledge you wish you had your whole career?
I wish that I understood how big a role mechanics in relation to stability and balance affects how the body moves.
Mm-hmm.
My first ever real experience with this was probably 3 or 4 years, maybe 3 years into working at Get Fit, We did a, I was FMS certified at that time, and we went through a breakout, or a deeper dive into it with this gym down in that the current owner knew, who was, they were very, very deep into the FMS. They, you know, I don't know if they were SFMA also or what, but they were, you know, like, I knew the level one, the basic stuff, enough to run a successful FMS and use it. These guys were like, okay, here's the active straight leg raise, and we're going to go through the all these different breakdowns and all these different correctives and, yeah. and what this shows and what this shows. And that was one of my first real delving into understanding that, like, for example, the active straight leg raise. For those of you that don't know, basically you're laying on your back, your legs are out straight, you're trying to keep one leg completely straight along the floor, and you raise the other leg up as high as you can. And most people would think hamstring flexibility or flexibility, right? Well, that was the first time I learned that if you, for example, if you were to have somebody engage their core, so you reach your arms up and you push forward on the, you know, whoever's doing the test, they create that tension, and their active straight leg raise gets better, it means that it's not so much a flexibility thing, it's a core synchronization thing, it's a hip flexor firing thing, there's all kinds of other things that are involved. And that was the first time that I'd ever kind of come across that it's not just about straight, like, flexibility of the tissue itself. It can be about how the body is posturally aligned. It can be about the stability. And I feel like that has changed so much of my coaching to understand, you know, somebody who can't, for example, can't squat to a decent depth. May not be that their knee doesn't have the movement. You could have, you know, you could, you personally, I'm literally pointing to Ross, could get them on the table and you could put them into hip flexion and their knee could be touching their chest. And then you get up and you tell them to squat and they can't get anywhere near, you know, parallel with that, with their leg to their hip. You put a weight in their hands and all of a sudden their butt's scratching the floor. Yep. You know what I mean? Like it, and just learning how stability works into everything. Their knee is sore when they run, and they can't, but they can't balance on one leg, so there's no knee stability. It's not because they have some, I mean, they could have arthritis, you don't know, but it's not because they have some advanced issue with the joint. It's not because their knees are shot. It's not because they tore their meniscus or an ACL, LCL, anything like that. It's just because they don't have knee stability, because something else is weak. And I wish that that is something, because that has, not only has that changed the way that I program and the way that I work around things, but it also has changed the way that I look at exercises when people are in pain. I remember I had somebody I was working with at when I was at Get Fit, and I can't remember what we were doing. It was something hip hinge related. I don't remember if it was a trap bar deadlift. I don't remember. It was something like that though. And they were wearing these super, you know, I don't remember if it was Hokas or something, but same idea, like pillow top.
Yeah, standing on a cloud.
Right, exactly. And when they went to pull that weight off the floor, they were like, "Oh, I feel this weird like pinching in my hip on one side," and I had them take off the shoes, so they were flat-footed on the ground, and they did it, and they didn't have pain. Well, simply because what I would see when they were doing it is you could see like their feet would do this little, when they went to go pull it, would do this little weeble wobble back and forth because they were basically sitting on clouds or standing on pillows. So they didn't have the stability. We take that away and they pulled without pain. I can't remember exactly what the exercise was, but it was something like that, something bilateral. And it was just like a, huh, I wonder if this will affect it. And we tried it and it did. Like, and that doesn't happen a ton with a bilateral exercise, but it's just cool that it allows me to look for those small little things. And to that person, it's like, why the fuck would me being in a pair of shoes cause pain in my hip, and you just, and like, that little thing you caught, and now it doesn't hurt? It's just a cool thing to be able to, like, make those little changes and see that stuff, because it's...
That's one of those where it's just a mic drop and you walk away. Don't even say anything.
Right.
How's it feel? Fine. Turn around and just walk. Deal.
I mean, there's a lot of that with... Like single leg squats, pistol squats, whatever you want to call it, and this is kind of a combination, but like realizing that people who didn't have good ankle mobility are not going to have a real decent shot at like a single leg squat. Not that I give those a lot, but just as an example, because that causes their center of gravity to go so far back, they don't have the balance. Not that they don't necessarily have the strength to do a single leg squat. Mm-hmm. It's that their base of support, their balance is all off when they go down past a certain depth. So they can't keep that same pattern. They can't get themselves up. They can't hold it. And it's not because they don't necessarily have the leg strength. It's because they don't have the stability and the balance.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've always thought that was cool since I learned a little bit more about it.
It's the putting the pieces together. You know, it's the learning the why. And that kind of carries me into my technical piece of knowledge. And there's really no one technique or anything or assessment that I would say over the course of years I wish I knew, because I've learned a lot over the last decade plus now. But clinical decision making, and that's basically what you were just talking about. When I was a new clinician, and new clinicians, so there are types of thinking. There's type 1 and type 2 thinking. Type 2 thinking is really what newer clinicians, newer trainers would use, and basically you break down everything through deduction. With a type 1 thinker, you know, you're recognizing patterns, and typically we see that with intermediate or expert clinicians, trainers, whatever we would see. My clinical decision making since my fellowship training or during my fellowship training has improved exponentially over the last 3 years. I wish I had that knowledge in my first 7 years. I think back now to patients that still haunt me. Like, I couldn't figure out what was going on with them, but I didn't know what I was looking for. So I could still, you know, have all these great techniques, but if I don't know why I'm using them or why I'm assessing something, I just wish I could have been a better clinician starting off. Because the problem is, you come out into the real world, you know, school leads you to believe that the red carpet's going to lay out for you and you're going to fix the world, you know, and everyone's just going to love you. And that's the furthest thing from the truth. You get a job, you're seeing, you know, maybe 10 patients a day, but up to probably more than 20, depending what setting that you're in. You don't have a lot of time to deal with people. You realize that, you know, it's a grind dealing with people every single day. You kind of get stuck in a rut and do the same thing day after day. And next thing you know, your treatments are all the same, and you just get clinical fatigue and burnout, you know. So then it's, oh, low back pain, stabilization exercises. Neck pain, mobility exercises. Oh, shoulder pain, yeah, we definitely need to get those rotator cuffs working. And I'm sure I fell into that bias. We all do. So I wouldn't think that I'm any different. Fortunately, I think school definitely helped kind of keep me out of the far left as far as that bias is concerned. So I transitioned a little bit, got better at it, but now my clinical decision making, you know, really the clinical decision making gives you a blank slate, you know, and you look at everything through an open lens, and it doesn't allow your biases to be reflected like they normally would. Because a lot of people, you know, we think about shoulder pain, for example. You know, you go to a clinician and it's one who doesn't know all the clearing tests, people that aren't really people that fall into their own biases, and they say, okay, it's only shoulder pain. Well, did you check the neck to make sure? Nope, because I know what it is. Wrong. Like, you have to prove to me that now it's not the neck. Because next thing you know, that could be a C4 or C5 lesion. So, you know, it's just little things like that. Now I look at things from a much bigger perspective, 30,000 foot view. What's everything that it could be? And then I have to hone in on it. So I just feel if I had that piece of information when I started off, man, I could have been a more efficient clinician when I started. You know, but unfortunately, you know, going the route that I did, kind of getting to where I'm at now. Again, it's all been a wonderful learning experience, but I stress enough to students. It's like, listen, if you can dial in your clinical decision making and understand the why, you're going to be a great clinician, you know, because if not, year one, you're going to suck. And that's just the way that it is. Year two doesn't suck as bad because you see more people. Year three, you finally become a lot more confident in your abilities. I was like, now if we can speed that up, you're going to enjoy the first 5 years of your career a lot more than I did. So What do you feel like the most, what's the most important thing that you've learned? And this can be one thing or it can be just a concept.
So I think one of the most important things that I've ever learned in over the course of the 10 years is that is to look for the valuable information in everything that I read, everything that I go through. I remember very early in my career, the previous owner of Get Fit saying something along the lines of, you know, he read a ton of different books. I mean, that's a big thing in the fitness industry is that you should read a lot. Like, it's not in every other industry, and just for your general knowledge. But I remember him specifically saying, if you can take one thing from a book, one small nugget, one piece of information you didn't have before, even if it's one paragraph in a 500-page book, it's worth the read. And I've really kind of taken that into, I'm always trying to look for the little things. I remember, you know, a few years after that, we watched a, we went through a thing, I actually had found it. It was Cressy talking about, oh man, I don't remember exactly what it was about, but it was about elbow pain.
Yeah.
And everything that he was talking about was like through the lens of working with, you know, major league pitchers and throwers and all this sort of stuff. But I remember there were like two or three little nuggets in there that's like, okay, well, that's something that could be going on with your, you know, your general population person. It doesn't, what he just talked about there isn't just related to somebody who throws 100-mile-an-hour fastball. You know, he's relating it to bench press. We have plenty of people that do chest press, bench press, and why can that cause elbow pain? Okay, well, I can take that. It doesn't matter that I'm not working with a $20 million a year athlete. The fact is that that mechanically, that gave me a small piece of information that I can then use on somebody else that's having elbow pain. Or, you know, I can try, you know, you'd say, if the, you know, try this, and then there were plenty of people that it was like, I'd never even heard of that before. Somebody has shoulder pain doing a push-up, and I watch a video from him talking about how throwers have really difficult can have difficulty with really tight serratus areas, and it can cause difficulty and impingement in the shoulder. And this person, I had them roll their they had them roll that area. It was the only thing we hadn't really tried. Oh, wow, my shoulder feels so much better. It's like,
yeah.
And that's just, you know, the person that I've been working with for years who just, you know, comes in 3-4 days a week for general training, just for health of body and mind and all that sort of stuff. And I got that piece of information by watching a video of someone that's working with a $100 million pitcher. You know, it doesn't matter. You're going to get little pieces of good information from all over the place if you always are going into it with the mindset of, I'm going to find something that will be helpful in this book, article, video, whatever it may be. I mean, even the ones that now I'm like, you know, BOSU ball stuff. And like this is 95% of this stuff isn't helpful to me. But there's always going to be that one thing. Yeah. Maybe it's not them standing on a BOSU ball. Maybe it's them saying that they do this exercise to help with stability. I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to put them on a BOSU ball, but that's not a bad idea. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like little stuff like that.
Well, and those are the, you know, so I call them the nuggets of wisdom or the clinical pearls. I read a lot of the same books over and over again. I read a lot of the same topics. I take a lot of the same classes. And that's because I always try to look for that one thing that can help me connect the dots, whether that's someone else's philosophy and mixing it in with my own. I mean, the second that we think we know it all, we should not be doing what we do.
I always love the quote that if you're the one, of course, I love the quote, and I can't remember the exact quote,
it's that good. It just gets you all giddy,
right? If you're the smartest person in the room, it's time to find a new room.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I just, you know, and I'll even tell instructors that when I go to their courses, and you know, it's like, hey, I'm just looking for that one tangible piece of information that I can take away, all worth it. So when I go into courses like that, you know, it one, you know, because you have to take a whole weekend, go to these freaking things, right. And it's like, all right, well, I'm going to meet other therapists with different treatment philosophies. I'm going to learn how they treat. I'm going to listen to the information that's being presented. I ask questions, and, you know, it's creating that dialogue that I think creates a well-rounded clinician, because now you're just talking shop with other people. You know, whereas if I go to like my brother's house for a random cookout on a Sunday, I'm like, you should have seen the humeral torsion in this kid's arm and causing elbow pain. My brother would be like, would you shut the fuck up? Like, I have no idea what you're saying. Just stop speaking. So it is nice to talk shop, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, you and I have always hit it off right from the beginning, because, you know, we're able to talk the same thing, speak the same language, which is always nice. You know, and for me, that kind of overall, the most important concept, I wish, and this concept is not necessarily anything that benefits me, but I wish it's more what I don't like about the profession. And this is like a lot of things we've talked about, education, the medical field. I wish the business of PT did not interfere with the art of PT, because I feel like we're very limited with what we can do under insurance grips, vice grips. And what I mean by that is a lot of patients need a ton of patient education, which they can bill for. However, now they're told by their, you know, administration's policies, you need to see X number of people per day for X number of minutes, because we get reimbursed the most on that. Everyone talks about patient-centered care, and it's the biggest crock of bullshit ever. You know, the patient's usually the last one involved in the conversation. Everyone makes all these great plans for the patient, and the patient has no say. So I think just being able to talk to the patient and being able to say, listen, this is what I can do for you. I can do it for you, or I can teach you how to do it yourself, which is why I typically show people exercises and get the hell out of here. Come back in a couple weeks and tell me what was good and what was bad. So I just wish we spent more time, one, not letting the business dictate things, but also at the same time, really creating, you know, active participation with the patient in their recovery. Because for, I'd say 60% of patients in general, just teaching them how to take care of themselves is going to take care of their condition. You know, and of course, that's not everyone. I'm just saying, you know, in generalities.
Broad strokes.
Yeah, exactly. Because there are the people that just don't want to do anything. They're the people that don't want to get better. You know, but that's why I like what I do here, because everyone's got skin in the game. And they're like, I want to get better. I want to see you less. And I'm like, I want to see you less, because that means you're getting better. So again, it's a shitty business model, but by not focusing on the business does well. It's just funny how that happens. Or I was talking to one of my patients who's also been a business mentor to me. And he's like, isn't it kind of funny how you don't worry about the money and the money finds you?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, yeah, it certainly has. So it goes along with that changing the relationship with money thing. But there's just a different way. And I just feel physical therapy is just stuck in a rut right now, and it needs to do something different. And everyone talks about it, but we're not able to do anything because we're held, we're basically a slave to insurance.
Yeah.
And that's the shitty part. So I'm very fortunate that I stepped away from that, and very fortunate that patients believe in me enough to want to be seen by me and not have to go through their insurance. So I know it wasn't really, you know, anything about me personally, but it's just my dislike for the profession and why I think that the profession's not going to evolve the way that it should. We've made tremendous strides, but medicine in general,
right,
is
right.
Just it's going nowhere fast. It's running in quicksand.
Seriously.
So, all right. Anything else that you wanted to blurt out for the listeners?
No, I think we're good.
All right. So that'll be the end of our reflections. Hopefully, you guys enjoyed this. I know it's enjoyable for Adam and I to kind of sometimes just sit back and take a lighthearted approach to these conversations, because sometimes we can get really into the weeds talking about different diagnoses, functional anatomy, exercises, things along those lines, which is all beneficial. But, you know, having a conversation like this where we can use less brain cells always helps us out. So, as always, we appreciate you guys. Again, if you have any questions, comments, feel free to reach out. All the information will be posted at the bottom in the details. So, until next week, take care.
Later.